Ladies and Gentle Beings, meine Daseinsformen und Menschen, herzlich willkommen zu Lightning Talks Nummer 2. Wir entschuldigen uns für die kurze technische Probleme, wie immer, aber wir können sofort beginnen. I think most of the people here speak English and some don't speak German, so let's keep it in English. Of course, if your talk is only in German, no problem, just talk at it. One thing, if you have trouble understanding the sound, we have this Kopfhörerstation. There you can get headphones and you can hear the audio directly. Also, you might notice that our beamer is very weak in the daylight. Sorry, we can't do anything about that. But on mediaccc.de, on the website where the stream is, you can see a live stream of this presentation with the slides. So you can have a little cheat sheet on your phone and see the slides if you absolutely cannot see anything. So far, so good. We're already a few minutes behind, so let's start with Kaspar about Kidspace. Is Kaspar here? Anyone who wants to hold a talk about Kidspace, K-I-T space? No one. Okay, that's fine by me. But then we have a little more time. Martin with his cyber deck. Oh yeah, there he is. A little applause for Martin. Moment.
Hello everyone. So you may be wondering what, if you can read that, it says, finally, the cyber future we were all promised. And this is really, when I was a kid, when I was a teenager, I read, probably many of you did here, the William Gibson books, the Sprawl books, like Neuromancer. And I always imagined that one day, We would just have cyber decks. We would just be there jacking into the matrix and all of that. And it didn't really happen. It's a bit sad, actually. You know, we're kind of hunched over laptops and staring at tiny mobile phone screens, and it kind of feels like we could do something better. And actually, we can now. So hidden inside this box is something really very smart. These are quite new, and they're just starting to become affordable. So what we've got here are some glasses with a USB-C input, which turn into essentially an HD screen for your phone, for your laptop. So you plug these things in, and all of a sudden, you have a giant screen up here in front of you. You don't have to hunch down. And it's a giant screen. You can have all your windows on here. And if you plug it into a device with USB-C DisplayPort Alt mode, then it kind of feels to me like you have your CyberDeck now. So this is a laptop. I got it off eBay because it had a broken screen. This was going to be e-waste. And got it off eBay. It runs Linux really well. It's a ThinkPad, so, you know, fingerprint recognition, all good. All the networking, display, all fine. These particular glasses are made by a company called X-Real, but this is not a sales pitch. There are a whole bunch of people, companies, who are making these products, so you'll see a whole ton of them now. And they're being sold as a kind of recreational thing, so they picture you plug it into your phone, and then you watch videos on it. Or maybe you, I don't know, read a book on it, or something like that. They're probably not anticipating that you're going to do something like this. So, like I say, these are becoming affordable, they're becoming available, and I would say around 300 euros. So it's still a lot of money, but it's not, you know, Apple augmented reality money. It's a little bit more affordable.
Spatial computing.
Spatial computing. Yeah, indeed. So these things are now possible. They're out there. And it's really interesting to think about, you know, if we have a whole ton of people using their technology this way, will it become the norm? So right now, you might say, why would you do that? That's a bit weird. Let's imagine you're a corporation who is really twitchy about privacy and security, corporate secrets, privacy of user data, all this stuff. Here I am on the train with my laptop, and maybe I have one of those fancy filters so people can't see what's on my screen. But yeah, if you're just lined up right, you can see what's on the screen. Good luck. Good luck seeing what's on the screen. I'm the only person who can see it. So it's really interesting to think, actually, right now, maybe we're kind of on the cusp of a new sort of computing paradigm. And right now it's for hackers, but maybe 2 or 3 years away, if you work for a big corporate, they'll say, okay, here is your computer, there you go, it's all locked down, so corporate image, Windows 2025 or whatever, and it will suddenly become boring. So I figure we've got maybe a couple of years where this is super exciting and fun and different, and then it will become kind of corporate and boring and dull. So I wanted to talk to you about it, and come and find me afterwards. Love to have a chat and show you how it works. But the key thing, technically, is not a hack in any way, shape or form. This just looks like a USB-C DisplayPort alt mode display. So it's just like you plugged one of those portable displays into your laptop, which again, remember, this was e-waste. Before I bought it, it was just going to go in a scrap heap. It maybe will get recycled. Perfectly good computer. So yeah, that's kind of all I wanted to say today. But if you can make it out, there's a QR code on there, which will take you to a little interview with me that a magazine did, which talks about the kind of thinking behind it. And it might be interesting. You maybe better look at picking it up off the stream. And I'm an @m@martinh.net on the Fediverse if anyone wants to catch me and talk about this. But I'll also be hanging around over there. Thanks very much.
Thank you. I really love it. I definitely read the cyberspace books, and I already saw a few projects where also people were building this, so I'm excited. Thank you very much. Just as a notice for the signal angel, you can just leave me on and I will mute and unmute my microphone myself. Thank you. Yes, if you cannot see this, remember all the streams are recorded, so later you can come back and check the QR code or look up the email address again. So no problem there. All right. Next one on my list is Robin about Open Steno project. Okay. Applause for Robin. Ten minutes.
Hello there, I'm Robin, and I'm here today to introduce you all to the Open Steno project. So first, let's talk about what stenography is. Stenography refers to, in general, methods of writing in shorthand so that we can write text more efficiently and with oftentimes better ergonomics than writing with a traditional keyboard or just with normal pen or pencil writing. So there are various forms it can take. There's machine stenography, which is where you have this thing that's kind of like a keyboard. And then there's pen and pencil stenography, where you use this system of drawing in little loops and lines to write words more quickly. And then there's also voice stenography, which is a thing that's been gaining more popularity within like court systems as a way to have someone speak into a microphone, which they have as a basically a face mask, and then use various commands to get the text out in a digital form. So, yeah, you're all familiar with this kind of keyboard, I assume. With a regular keyboard, you can get up to a speed of about 120 words per minute. And that is limited by the fact that you have to enter one letter at a time. And you really have to sequence all of those in the right order. And some words use multiple letters just to represent a single sound. So this all kind of slows you down and creates a barrier there. But with a stenography keyboard, you can write up to speeds of 250 words per minute if you practice enough. And so this really allows you to write at speeds that can then keep up with conversation. And this is why stenography is what's used for real-time captioning of live TV, and also taking the transcript of court proceedings. And so this is what the English steno keyboard usually looks like. You have, on the left side here, you have consonants that can start a syllable. And then in the middle here, you have vowels. These are pressed with your thumbs. And then on the right side, you have the consonants that can end a syllable. And the idea is that you're really writing one syllable, one entire syllable at a time, rather than an individual letter. And so you write, instead of just single key presses, you write with entire chords. So if I wanted to write the word start, I would press all five of these keys at the same time. Just press them and release. So S-T-A-R-T, and that will output start onto whatever your machine is. Could be a computer, could be a professional writer. And the other feature of this is that spelling is phonetic, which helps us sort of reduce the number of letters that are here on the keyboard, because we don't actually need the letter C, because the letter C in English generally only represents either the sound made by K or the sound made by S. And so here, if we wanted to write cat, you just do K-A-T. That outputs cat. But you might notice that there are still some sounds that are just completely missing. Like, what if we wanted to write laugh? There's no L here on the left side let you write that initial consonant. So what we do is actually use the combination of H and R. You press both of those together with your finger. You sort of put your finger between the keys, and that then forms the L sound. And there are a lot of different sounds hidden on this keyboard and other shortcuts that really let you start writing efficiently. The Open Steno Project has then been, it's a community of people who have been putting together various hardware, firmware, but also open source software projects that allow hobbyists to really get involved in this. And so there are a few different options for how you can use Steno on your own devices as an input method. So there's software. There's this software called Plover, which you run on your computer, and then it reads your keyboard input, and it translates that into words based on which keys you're pressing. So you can really use any keyboard, well, any N-key rollover keyboard, because you have to be pressing multiple keys at once, as a stenography input. But there are also some other options, like firmware. So there are some boards, like this one I have here, where you can actually flash this thing with firmware called Javelin, which then the English dictionary is basically stored on this device, the dictionary used for translation lookup from key presses to words. And then when you press a chord on this keyboard, it just acts like a normal keyboard to the computer it's connected to and outputs all of the key presses needed for that word in sequence. So it just looks like you're typing out the word very fast. But then there's also some other options like hardware, this thing called a Stenogachi. It's a do-it-yourself project that you can put together and basically put it between your keyboard and your computer. And on this board is where the translation from your key presses into words would happen. And so it's basically doing the part that the firmware here in this other option plays. So yeah, the whole reason why this project exists is to make Steno more accessible. Because if you look at professional writing machines, the ones that court reporters use, they cost on the order of $2,000 US just to get the machine, and also education programs to learn how to use these things cost many more thousands of dollars. But the stuff that this community has put together really allows you to get into stenography with a fairly low investment. There are options out there for mechanical keyboards that come with this sort of English steno layout that you could get for around $100. And there, you can also go fully DIY and put together a board yourself. This is probably the most fun. And there are some really interesting designs you can do, split keyboards or whatever you really want for ergonomics or just aesthetics. So if this was at all interesting to you, here's some resources. You can visit the project at openstenoproject.org. And yeah, if you want to contact me to ask me any questions, there's my website where you can find my contact information. Yeah.
Great, thank you very much. Yeah, you can just put the microphone there. So this is more like playing a piano, right?
Yes.
With the music, several key presses. All right, great. Thank you. Who's next on my list? Vringar, V-R-I-I, okay, all right. Maintaining a healthy relationship to a project. Ooh, all right. Small applause, and let's go.
So this is just going to be me talking about how I fucked myself up by not having a good relationship with a project that I maintain, how I got better, and hopefully some lessons learned for you all. Let's give some general context. So yeah, I'll mostly be reading off these slides anyway, so it's not too bad that you can't read them. So OpenWPM is a web crawler that is used in privacy research, mostly academic privacy research. It's a hodgepodge of Python, a custom web extension, and using Firefox. It then goes and crawls the web, observes how websites behave, what kind of tracking they employ, writes it all out to a database so it can be analyzed afterwards. It was originally created at Princeton's WebTap Lab and brought to Mozilla by Steven Englehart when he joined the company. My involvement with the project started in 2019 when I joined Mozilla as a working student to contribute to OpenWPM. During the course of the next year, I became its effective maintainer, being involved with like both volunteer efforts but also internal efforts to improve the project, add new capabilities, maintain our stuff, keep it up to date. Once I exited the company and could see that there was no clear way forward to maintain it internally, I asked them to basically hand over the project to me and move it into a separate GitHub org outside of Mozilla where I could then keep on maintaining it. At least that was my initial goal. However, I started another job a week after I exited Mozilla, and that left me in a bit of a dilemma. How would I keep up with all of this, well, aging code base that had been hacked together piece by piece, one feature at a time, which was in active use by a community that was not interested in writing code, but in just getting some data together, putting out a paper, and moving on. When there's like significant bugs, structural issues, and basically no good docs, which left me then in the position where I was the only one with the knowledge and the motivation to keep it going. This motivation was not a healthy motivation. It was a motivation out of pride and guilt. It was me thinking, this is a great tool. I am its maintainer. I should take care of it. Why am I putting more time in it? This arrogance almost of like, I have to save the world with this tool. I have to give this community something because they deserve it, because they do work that I deem important. But faced with the realities of not getting paid for it anymore and having other stuff to do, which I think, yeah, a lot of open source maintainers struggle with, I was just left with this crushing anxiety about the state of the project, where I didn't want to touch it because I felt like I should address the big issues first and the small issues could wait. And because I didn't have time to address the big issues, I just didn't. Realizing that I had fallen behind more than 6 months of Firefox releases, I took a step back. I asked myself where I wanted this project to go, and I also realized that the project was still very much in active use. There had been more than 80 papers published within the 2 years where I had basically not touched the project at all. And so I decided for myself and for the project that this is not my thing anymore. This is not what I am. I am not the project. But instead, the project is a thing that exists on its own, and I will put as much time and energy into it as is fun for me, as is sustainable for me. And yeah, except that things being broken apparently isn't a deal breaker because it's still getting used. Like, it had been used before with the issues in place. And once I did that, I was able to come back. Now I'm like putting out every month when a new Firefox release drops. I'm updating OpenWPM as well. I'm fixing bugs when they interest me. I am aware of the big issues, but I can live with them being there. And yeah, I don't know. This was me rambling, me reflecting, but I hope for people that have things in their life that are like too big to address them right now, don't let them crush you. Do take a step back, evaluate what is realistic, what is possible, and then move on from there. Because otherwise, you'll just burn out, crash, whatever, and that's not good for anybody, especially not yourself. Quick shout out. This template was created by Marai. You can find her in the LaTeX village. It's really cool. Use it. Come visit. They host me. Like, I have my tent there. So thanks for thanks for that, and thanks for the template. And yeah, that was it. Sorry.
Thank you very much. That was actually pretty inspiring, if you ask me. I mean, everyone knows this joke, like it's not a bug, it's a feature. But to make actually a philosophy out of that thinking, that's pretty cool. And I think you can also apply that for your private life. I mean, if I'm sitting at home and I actually should clean my room, but I don't want to, and so on. And so on. Who's next? Julian about hang gliding. Oh, nice. Let's see what this is about. Julian. Do you really want to sign in front of everyone?
I don't know what it is. Do I have to sign in? No, it's anyone who can sign in who gave the link to. Anyone with a link, it says, can use it.
Anyone with a link can use it?
Yes.
Well, no, this one says log in, please.
Yeah, that's because no one's logged in at all.
Yes, because it's a live Linux system, so...
Okay.
Maybe you can just give it. Don't pull the live system out, please. Just give it to the signal angel, and he will put it on a USB stick, and then you can come back. We apologize for the technical difficulties, but we shall have the presentation soon. Meanwhile, is Alessandro here? Ah, yeah. Ah, he has the same USB stick. Oh, no. Doesn't matter, we still have lots of time, we're only halfway through. So let me tell a few jokes, I don't know. Yes, a bit of info. I don't know if every one of you knows that, but in the hub of the camp, there's this hidden website called Dating. And it's not about dating like let's meet behind the bush and do stuff, but it's about like I am seeking a device, or I have a device that's seeking a hacker, or I have some food left that is seeking someone who will eat it. And so if you just go on the hub, the website, you search for dating, you will find a wiki page that you can just edit and write in. I'm looking for this guy who was holding this cool talk. Contact me here and there and stuff. There's also lots of categories, and lots of people have already written stuff in. So go have a look there. Also, don't forget to drink water. That's always important. Meanwhile, is there an ETA on when the presentation will be ready? Ah, I see a stick changing hands. Great. So let's say who's first, you or you? Yeah, just give the stick to him. You can race each other. Okay, there you go.
Wrong presentation. Okay.
What? Ah, okay. Then let's have the presentation of Alessandro first. Okay. Is it just?
Yeah, I just wanted to like that. Ah.
Already, it's one slide. It was worth the effort. Okay, here's your microphone.
Thank you.
10 minutes, let's go.
Yeah, it's actually only one slide, so it wasn't that crucial. Hello, everybody. My name is Alessandro Polidoro. I am a lawyer and an advocate for digital rights. My work mainly pertains cyber crimes and data protection law violations. Mainly, I also deal with platform accountability, which, to put it simple, is suing big platforms. That's what I like to do in my job. And today I'm here to talk to you about one of the cases that I'm following that I like quite a lot, because it's a lawsuit against a website that I believe some of you may have heard of sometimes. It's called Pornhub. I don't know if it, you are familiar with it.
And I have never heard of it.
Yeah. I didn't even know, as a person had to tell me that it existed. I never heard of it before. No, as you know, Pornhub is one of the major porn platforms out there. It's also the 12th most visited website on the planet. And their data protection compliance is trash. At least for what we have had the chance to document. Just a little bit of context. So this project that I'm presenting to you today is called Stop Data Porn. It's a broader campaign that has been launched 1 month ago. You can look us up. There is the hashtag and the website. And yeah, feel free to take a look if you want. Also, there is all our contacts in case you are interested to, and you want to know more after what I'm going to tell you today. It comes from this research that has been made by a group called Tracking Exposed in the past 2-3 years. And it was mainly an academic research aimed at spotting the bias of the recommender system of the platform. So there was this bunch of amazing researchers. They were scraping the platform with our customized bots and tools, and they were trying to reverse engineer basically the algorithm that it's used for content recommendation and targeted advertisement on Pornhub. What we found out with this research was that, surprise, surprise, it's very sexist. and it's biased with heteronormativity, so basically just enforcing and repeating on loop the male gaze. If you are a white, straight man, you're going to find everything you like and the advertisement will be perfectly tailored on you. But if you belong to the other weird categories of I don't know, people, because the algorithm will react very weirdly, put you in some weird niche. So there was a beautiful paper published about that. But then at some point, especially when I joined the project, we looked at everything that we found, and we realized that it was also very illegal. What they were doing was extremely problematic in many senses. So the whole litigation, it's ongoing, and it's happening at the same time in Italy, which is where I'm from, maybe you may have guessed it by my accent, and in Cyprus, which is where Pornhub is from, or at least their legal entity for GDPR issues. Their data controller is based in Cyprus. For some reason, these tech platforms really love to be on small islands. The biggest the company, the smallest the island. and so... What's the issue with this? What is the data protection law violation that I want to tell you about? There are mainly three issues. If we want to count the articles that they are violating, are more than 10. But there are three issues. The first one is lack of consent. The second one is the dissemination of the data that they're gathering, the personal data that they're gathering. And the third one is the way their algorithm works. Let's start from the first one. So consent. Consent is such a ubiquitous and transversal topic when it comes to sexuality and technology, right? There is consent, of course, in a sexual context, but it's also consent for cookies. And as of the beginning of our campaign, so the public launch of our campaign happened on June, the end of June of this year, there was nothing on Pornhub.com to ask for consent. There was not even the most basic I accept or okay, whatever. There was just a super tiny banner that say, we use cookie. Stop, deal with it. And you know, like this is quite ridiculous when you think of all the even YouTube, you know, is asking for consent. It's 2023, you know, every platform is realizing that they have to ask for consent, and they cannot just base the personal data processing on legitimate interest or what they consider is their interest of running their business. And they were not caring for that at all until we launched the campaign. So it took us 3 weeks to shame them publicly, and then the 12th most visited website on the planet changed their own page because we told them to. This is, of course, a very small victory because we don't want them to, you know, get free GDPR compliant consultancy from us. We want them to either change their business activity significantly or stop doing it at all. But let me be clear, this is not a movement that is supposed to go against sexual representation as a whole thing. We can have another conversation of what are the, you know, implication of pornography and all the possible feminist perspectives on it. But we are just focusing here about protecting sensitive data, because that's the point of consent. They know the sexual preference of people. YouTube, I listen to music on YouTube, I have to confess that. And YouTube knows, I don't know, what is my favorite Bob Dylan album. Pornhub knows what people like in bed or wherever they do their stuff, you know? And they cannot possibly acquire and process this information without any public oversight, without any scrutiny from regulators and civil society. And the reason why they were not asking for consent, we believe, is because this would have reduced their traffic on the web page. Because they know that if they put the button, many people will just say, I consent, but some other will not. And so it's nice to think that they are basically losing money right now. The second issue is the dissemination of this data. Because it's not only that they take it, but then where does the data go? We don't know. And there is no way to know it. When we ask them, of course, we first scraped the platform, so we asked, knowing already the answer to the question. We called it the Kansas City Shuffle, if you know Lucky Numbers 11, the movie. Otherwise, go check it out. We asked them, what are the third parties on your website? Then they gave us a small list. And we said, I'm sorry, but we actually would like to know if you're also giving the data to this and this and this other platform. And I have it written in an official email from the data protection officer of Pornhub. They said, oopsie, there was a technical error when we were compiling the email. We forgot this. Thank you for asking. Come on. Anyhow, it's funny, but it's also very creepy, right? Because Pornhub is not even a company. Pornhub is run by a company that is called MG Free Sites Limited, that is based in Cyprus. But MG stands for MindGeek. And MindGeek is a huge corporate conglomerate that has its legal headquarters in Luxembourg and most of its offices in Canada. And they own roughly 170-something companies all around the world. There was a great research, OSINT research, that a person from Poland did. Offensive OSINT is the project that run the investigation in this sense. Great guy, go check it out. And not only that, because this year, MindGeek has been bought by a private equity firm, which is even bigger, that is called Ethical Capital Partners. And it's even bigger, you know? And I think yesterday or a few days ago, they announced that there is a new spokesperson from this company. She's a woman. And is now on this mission of purifying and requalifying the brand of Pornhub. But so imagine, not only the third parties outside of this corporate conglomerate, but also just within themselves. They have basically a parallel ecosystem where they take care of all the pipeline of porn production, because they go from casting to production to distribution to analytics and so on. And there is we don't know anything about it. For some reason, the cultural taboo that revolves around pornography has shielded them from any significant scrutiny. And the last point of the litigation, and the last thing that I want to talk about, if I still have time, I lost a bit track. 1-2 minutes, yeah. Is the algorithm, because it's not like, I don't know if you're familiar with that South Park episode where there is the fat guy behind all those screens and he's looking at, I don't know if you know it. But anyway, it's not a person that is spying on all the people having fun on these porn platforms. It's, of course, an algorithm. And this algorithm is automatically assigning a sexual preference to each user, regardless of the fact if you have an account or not. We have documented and observed how the platform, if you have an account, just, of course, keeps track of all the content you view on your profile. But if you don't have an account, what happens is that there is an identifier for each video you view that gets stored in your browser, in the local storage of your browser, and then stays permanently there. And it's also like the funny thing is that even if you do a basic refresh of cookies or you restart your browser, it's gonna stay there. So, you know, you have a parallel history of your porno just somewhere in your browser. You might not even know about it. And the funny thing is that an average user, especially think of all the young people that use these platforms, they don't know that this algorithm is assigning them a preference. So at some point they will start having we all know the phenomenon of the echo chamber, the filter bubble. All of a sudden they will be like, oh wow, everybody is into, I don't know, stepsisters or I don't know, like MILF, what's going on? Okay, it must be definitely the new trend today. And maybe it's just the algorithm that for some reason has decided that they now are into that. And this is funny, but think of the case when the algorithm decides that a person is heterosexual or homosexual or anything sexual, and they're not. So they don't know it. They have to keep up with the decision of the algorithm that has been made on their behalf, and they cannot challenge it. There is no system in practice for that. It is quite creepy, especially if we consider the part regarding, for instance, gay people and the idea that there is a machine that lists gay people and then it's stored somewhere in the server of a shady corporate conglomerate. Imagine, let's pretend that everything is fine, you know, for a second, and it's not, but let's pretend it is. What happens when there is a leak? And maybe like a political group with a discriminatory agenda gets their hand on this list. It's a huge risk. So we're suing them, and we're doing it in Italy. The Italian Data Protection Authority has already started the trial. They have time until the 1st of September, so very soon, to reply to our inquiries and the inquiries of the Italian Data Protection Authority. So if you want to know more about how this thing is going to go, follow us everywhere you'll find us. And yeah, of course, the last thing that I can say, the project is gonna expand, because at the moment it's a litigation based on GDPR against Pornhub. We want to sue more porn platforms. We want to use not only the GDPR, and we also would like to turn it into an advocacy campaign, because we must talk about sexuality online, because the problem is related to thank you. Because the problem is related to personal data, the problem is related to safety of people. Think of the online gender-based violence, think of child sexual abuse material, think of non-consensual dissemination of sexual explicit content. There are so many topics that revolve around the topic of sexuality and are happening in digital world in the most unsafe way. Let's stop that. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. That was a bit longer than 10 minutes, but of course I totally agree. All right, the last presentation, did you find a solution? Yes, yeah. There you go. We still have 10 minutes. Yeah. Sein Mikrofon ist an. Könnt ihr das mal anschalten?
Okay.
Hello.
Okay. So this looks like it works. So I decided to do this talk because of the talk later on about some CAM and sort of weird machining algorithms and stuff for doing slicing of stuff in and that's about 6 o'clock. And because I actually had a long business in doing exactly these types of software for about 20 years, I thought maybe I got something to say. So I spent 10 years writing this software here, which was for running CNC machine tools in industry, had to make it really high speed and stuff. And after I'd been doing it for a while, the company then got a customer. They got a customer of the one remaining hang glider company in America. They made about 200 hang gliders a year or something like that. And obviously, because it's much better than most of the things you'd cut pieces of automobile or something, they could stick the hang gliders on the brochures and make it look beautiful. And then I went to a trade show in America and they had a hang glider on the stand. And I did a bit of hang gliding when I was in university. So it didn't take very long before the inevitable happened. They gave me a phone number of this lady who took me up to the top of the mountain and said, don't worry. It's like riding a bicycle. You can never forget. Okay. And so off we go straight into the air. and it was pretty good. I liked that. And after a while, I then went and got my own hang glider with all the right colors for the corporation and all the logos. And I got the body bag that was the same colors, and it's pretty good. And then here's a photo of one of the first crashes. And at the top is the textbook of how you land. You just come down all horizontal, and then you just go straight up. And what I'm doing is I'm going sideways into a hedge in a field. I broke a few things then, but you know, it's all right. For guys who want to learn, so what I say about hang gliding is the best bit is the learning bit. Then it's kind of like you get used to it, and then it's not magic anymore, really. So the way you learn is they stick you on some strings and let you up in the sky, and you learn how to steer it a little bit. And then after you've done, if you learn in France, after you've done a few days of that, they put you off this cliff edge ramp. And the thing is, it looks really dangerous, but the bigger the drop, the safer it is, because you need to get away from the ground. That's the only thing that's going to hurt you. So it's all in the mind. You know, you think something which is a bit more gentle. No, you're going to hit the ground then. So that's sort of a thing. And if you don't want to learn to fly, you can go as a buddy of someone. They'll take a super large wing and they can fly you around. And let's see. So like I said, that was about 2012 I picked it up, hang gliding again. And well, right, yeah, I'll be done soon. Picked it up. And in that time, I've had some pretty amazing flights. So this was after a 5-hour somewhere in the Alps, right above all the mountains. And that's like a little map of the route through all the mountains. And here's me at about, 3,600 meters above a glacier on the way back, with nothing between me and the ground, but just a little bit of aluminium. So, skip that one. Right, so do a little bit more detail. This is not a hang glider, this is a paraglider. They're actually more advanced than a hang glider and were invented later, but I don't deal with them. And what we want to do is, what's it all about? So we had a lot of books of people flying dragons and in what's it, Avatar. It's all basically that. You basically just got a pair of wings attached to you. And it's what I'd say, it's like one of these human body augmentation, like a bicycle. It's suddenly magic. Your body fits this machine and you can do 10 times more than you could do otherwise. You know, maybe skis are like that. And a hang glider is another of these special machines that just fits the human body perfectly. A little bit about how it steers is essentially you're just hanging like a pendulum, and you've got a bar on the bottom, and you move the bar, and that basically moves your weight, and that puts different amounts of stuff on the wings or something. There's a bit of distortion in the wings. Now, and then there's such a long history of it. They've been going since 1970. That they've all different shapes and sizes when they started. They've adapted and got better and better at flying. Safer in some ways, I guess. That was another little flight. And then if you get really bored, you can start doing competitions. So this is like all the top 50 people in Great Britain who fly hang gliders. They all come on the same competition, and they all hopefully not crash into each other in the cloud. But they just set a GPS coordinate. You go there, and then you all try and race there. I don't do too well. Now, so just going back to the old design. Anyone use FreeCAD anywhere? Right? So this is a FreeCAD is the only open source CAD modeler. So I spent 20 years writing closed source SolidWorks stuff, and I don't ever want to do that again. And I have a friend who went and bought a hang glider factory in England and has started designing new gliders, and I've been writing software to help him cut the wing shapes. And he actually was using this. I couldn't believe it. And this is one of the wings he's made. It looks a bit different from a normal glider, but this is for sticking a motor on it. He might actually make a living by selling like more than two a year or something. Because the thing about making hang gliders is you can't make any spare. You have to sell everything you make because there's no money. So that's pretty much the end. It happened a little bit earlier this year. I took off on this mountain here, somewhere down. You can see a bunch of little gliders in the bottom left. I took off on there and the wing turned to the side, and I was bracing for the impact. And came out, I don't know how, and I thought, I was God above the mountain, somewhere about here, and I thought, if I stop doing this, I won't die. So, and I got very happy. So maybe I should stop doing it. So anyway, I'm very looking forward to the talk at 6 o'clock about the CAM and how to write that stuff. Do you know who it is?
What?
Who's doing the talk at 6 o'clock?
What time is it?
Oh, at five, yeah. Anyway.
It's not, yeah. It's not 3 o'clock.
Okay, so that's it.
Thank you very much. So basically, you are going to have a talk about this software.
Someone else is talking about making machining stuff.
All right. And you wanted to recommend that.
I want to talk to them.
Yes, okay. So your glider project, is it something that people can join also on GitHub or something? Or
do you want to do a glider?
No. Maybe people can talk to you if they're interested.
Yeah.
Anyway, you don't need to plug in because we're done here. Thank you very much, because the next talk is already waiting. I wish you all a happy next day and the next few days on the camp. Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Nordics stage. And now we will talk about non-English-based programming in an English talk by Hogu 456. Give him a warm welcome and enjoy the talk.
Yeah. So, hello and welcome to the talk. So, I have not done this talk on my own. I have done it together with another person. That's also because it's in English. And the other person has also recorded a part of this presentation. So, I will now show at the beginning a short video with the first part of the presentation. Then afterward, I will do the second part of this presentation live. Yeah, and I hope you enjoy so far, yeah, and it will work. Okay, does it work with sound, or what do I need to do? Was muss ich machen? I thought should be sound in this video. Okay, why? I thought there's also a sound in this video, but yeah. Okay, yeah, then I will do it that way. If it now does not work, that's, yeah, so it is. But yeah, so it's, you can see a DNG Botu with, who wants to do the first part, and at the beginning he's talking about non-English based programming and what it is about. Yeah, DNG Botu is from Ghana and he has also experience with other languages, so he's not a native English speaker. He speaks a long time, but is not a native English speaker. Yeah, now he will show you here a bit about what is the presentation about. So at the beginning it's a bit about a bit introduction into visual, into non-English based programming. You can see now a definition of visual of non-English based programming. It's a programming language that do not use English keywords. And and so there's now a bit an introduction about it, and yeah, it's at least the thesis. I'm not yet sure, as I think more about it if it's really easier if keywords are not in English for non-English based speaker, or if it's just something what you need to learn and then you can do it though. But yeah, at least that was the idea behind the talk, and the talk was introduced into Wiki for the Wikimania, but then there it was not accepted, so I decided to put it here into the camp and maybe I find some people who are interesting. Yeah, so he's now talking a bit more about non-English based programming and why it is necessary, or why it could help maybe. So I need to say why it maybe could help people. And now here's now afterwards, now you can see here a bit an explanation on how you can use non-English based programming. And one thing what you can do in the most programming language, you can define own functions, and then you can choose for the functions names that depend on the programming language. That's a bit difficult. Now, not in every programming language you can use all characters for function names, but in most programming languages many characters for function names. Yeah, so here you can see a bit and explanation how it is possible to define it in Python. So then you write the def and then the function and then afterwards the function. But I am not so experienced with Python. I am mostly using the programming language R, what you will see afterwards. And now then will be now a second example of another programming language and how you can define it in there. And yeah, so yeah, here now you can see how you can define a function in Ruby. So there's also the def keyword used for it, and then and then you can see how you can define it with def and then writing afterwards the function name, and then in the next line the code that should be executed by the function, and afterwards an end. And so then you can say what should be used by the function. Now the next topic what I will talk about and I will do live is visual programming languages. So yeah, now I will talk about other use cases for non-English based programming where it is used. And the first one I want to talk about are visual programming languages, because I think at least maybe who of you has heard about, for example, programming language Scratch or Snap? Have you? Yeah. Okay, yeah, at least some people have heard from it, yeah. And so this is an example of an programming language. Both are examples of programming languages where it is possible to writing kind of small sentence, or there are also many available when you download it. And then you can combine these blocks through drag and drop, and then you can execute it. When you then click on it or you click on a symbol, then you can run the code, and then you can see the result immediately after, and then you see what is the result. And so for example used for some animations. And yeah, so it's more an educational language, but at least in Snap there is also some more advanced feature that you can do, at least from my point of view, more as with Scratch. Yeah. And what you can do there is also you can define own blocks, so you can use it then for other things if you want to do it on it. There's also some advanced feature, you can map then source code to blocks, and then yeah, but I don't have so much experience with the implementation of that feature. And it's also something what's provided from Blockly, what as far as I know included in both of those, what's more is the basis, at least in Scratch I'm sure that is. And in Snap, I'm not completely sure how far it is based on Blockly. That's a framework what you can use if you want to have a block-based user interface for something. Yeah. And now I want to give you a bit of an overview where you can use non-English-based programming. I think the most common use case for non-English-based programming are spreadsheet functions. Spreadsheet functions are translated into many languages. For example, I usually using German spreadsheet function, yeah, and I would say I really like it that they are translated into different languages. And so, but it can also be because I usually using the German ones, then I have sometimes difficulties when I talk with someone who has a spreadsheet program with English spreadsheet function to find the right English spreadsheet function for the same, it was equivalent to the German one. Yeah, and they, at least LibreOffice, they are translated into many languages. I don't know how many languages the spreadsheet functions of Excel are translated to, but yeah, at least I can say in LibreOffice they are translated to many things. Yeah, and now what you can also do, and what you have seen there in some examples, you can translate functions into your language, function names into your language, and this is possible in the most programming language. I will show later a link to Rosetta Code where you can find an collection where you can find how to define your function in many different programming languages. But first I want to show you here an example of a spreadsheet function. There you can see two functions, the mit function and the teil function, German, and they do both the same. In this case, it extracts out of the cell A2 a string starting at the character 3 and what is 5 characters long. And so, yeah, what you can see is how there are two differences. But yeah, what is a bit special, spreadsheet functions, there it depends on the country where you live, what is the decimal separator, and that's one of the reasons why it has someone a comma or a semicolon as a separator. Yeah, that's a bit something what makes it more complicated when you use spreadsheet functions. And now I want to show you, because I am usually using the programming language, I want to show you how you can use it in the programming language, and depending on the time, I will maybe later show you, because it's also relatively easy to map a new function name to an existing function name. That I want to show you how this is possible. Yeah. And now I want to, here is now this site I mentioned before. It's Rosetta Code, and site where a lot of programming examples and different programming languages are collected. And there is also a task for function definition, and you can look at it if you are interested how to translate functions into your language. And as I also think I also mentioned before, yeah, it depends a bit on what characters you can use for function names. For example, in R I had some difficulties when I used an older R function, but I'm not sure if it depends on the R function or on the operating system, both. There I had difficulties when I wanted to use some names. I experimented a bit with Doug Bunny names, and then some names haven't been allowed, so I was not allowed to use these names. But yeah, that's something I experienced a bit, so I can't give you a guarantee that you can use a name you want to use for a function. It's a bit difficult, yeah. And so now I will try to show you a bit how you can see here. That's the way. So if you want to do it a bit more advanced, you can also look, at least in R, it's also possible to translate the arguments of a function. As I can show you here, the data frame function, you can see here, there are several optional arguments. Wait, it's a bit more top, yeah, here you can see there are several optional arguments, and then it's possible in R also to translate these optional arguments, but that it's a bit more difficult if you also want to do it. I experimented a bit with it, but have not done so many. And what I want to show you here now is, for example, the substr function. If I want to extract out of this name the first yes, I can look if I can zoom in. Oh, I don't know how it will work here. Oh, wait, I will look if find it very soon. But I do you know where, how I can make it here bigger, this? Yes, I tried it, but it did not work. So I currently don't know. I think I've seen. Yeah, so So what I want to show you here is, wait, I would then tell it. So if you, for example, if I want to name it as the German spreadsheet function tile, then I can just put here the first, the tile, and then, and there are two possibilities with lower than minus or an equal sign. You can assign something in R, and so then I now say that the it's the same substrate and tile, and then now if I write the same thing, then okay, now I had a mistake here. I had to put one colon. Yes, no. So now that does the same. It also extracts the same word, so it's not so easy. But then you need to pay attention if you are using it in that way. I usually try to define it as a function. Yeah, then it's a bit. Oh yes, then it's a bit easier. But yeah, not easier to do. But I had there sometimes with difficulties. So I did it the other way. Good, now I want to say thank you. Oh, there's the presentation there, and I want to show the contact information. So here you can see if you want to contact us, you can see the names. Now I want to say thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions?
So, what if you need to work together with people from different countries, different languages? So, what would you recommend for that? Because I mean, then if you rename all the functions to German, and then they may only speak English, because that's more known than German in this case, and then it's for them it's then more difficult than if it was in English. So is there a way to deal with that?
Yes, I have a bit experimented with translating things automatically from one language to another, a programming language from one programming to another. I experimented a bit with it, and I think it is possible. It is possible, at least as long as you only translate the function names, then it is possible that you can find a system, but I would not recommend it. It's more an experimental thing, and I'm also not sure how far non-English-based programming is useful, but I think at least I think it's interesting to try it. So it is possible. I have experimented a bit with it, with the automatic translation of functions from one programming language into another. So I think that's if you really want to enable, I think that's an important thing. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Have such a system.
Is there another question? If not, I would suggest we thank our speaker for this nice introduction. And continue the program shortly.